welcome to Authors First on the Artists First Radio Network, artistsfirst.com. Tony Kay in the studio. Thanks for joining us, everyone, worldwide. To learn more about artistsfirst.com, we've provided a number of important links. If you're an author or independent recorded artist, we'd love to hear from you. Or maybe you just have a great idea for your own weekly show on Artists First Radio. Simply follow the links we've provided, just as we have for our guest coming up this hour, Andrea Clinton, author of Life Knows No Bounds. She's all over the World Wide Web, fabulous author, receiving high reviews, and it's our privilege to welcome her back to the Artists First airways. How you doing, Andrea Clinton?
I'm great. How are you?
Wow. Probably just as busy as you are.
Okay, so that must be really busy.
It's really busy. And I love it because we're offering a format, Andrea, that is exciting worldwide. We have listeners from every point on the globe, and we're a member of Spodtronic, which is a family of 400 European radio stations, and we're the only one offering our type of material with interviews with authors and independent recorded artists. It's a very exciting day.
Yes.
Just as it is for authors who now can benefit from e-books and the mechanical devices that make that possible.
Yes.
You're finding...
Sort of, kinda.
Yeah. Now, this is a great era for mechanization of computer technology, and by the wonders of technology, we're able to connect with you, Andrea Clinton, and those of you on the web, go up to your Google or whatever search engine you choose, and put in the name Andrea Clinton, author, Life Knows No Bounds, and you'll find a tremendous library of information, probably stuff, Andrea, you didn't know.
I know.
Yeah, it's out there.
Every now and again, I Google myself just to see.
Yeah, just to check. And then, of course, there are the blogs and social networking. Where were we with Twitter 10 years ago?
I know.
Well, that's right. It wasn't there. Facebook. Nope, wasn't there. MySpace. Nope, wasn't there. So look what's happened in the last decade for authors to get their message out. So, Andrea Clinton, thank you for being that type of generation, this new generation of author.
Oh, well, thanks for having me on the show to discuss it and just try to, you know, take my authorship to another level. I mean, it's a long struggle when you're the publisher as well, but I'm definitely, you know, on that journey and just trying to, you know.
Wow, you mean you're wearing more than one hat?
Yes. Yes.
You hear that, audience? You hear what's going on here, don't you, audience? Creative control, you know, 20 years ago, that was a much debated and coveted position to be in. If you were Elvis Presley, if you were whoever the creative artist happened to be, or author, maintaining creative control, that was highly coveted.
Yeah.
And today, we're able to do it as independents. And certainly, that's part of what you're all about.
Yes, definitely, and it's not easy. It's a big job, and the thing is the technology is just overwhelming because it seems the technology is changing, rearranging, and so on and so forth so often that sometimes I literally have to take a couple of days off just to rest my brain, really. You know, from uploading books onto Kindle, I did it in 2009, and it was one way, and then I come to find out they had changed a few things. So not Twitter, did I say Twitter? Kindle. I found out that they had changed a few things, so I had to go and look at it, and I saw it was all over the place, so I had to upload it again. And it wasn't as tedious, but, you know, it was a few things that I had to do. So it's just things rapidly changing. You know, like you said, mechanically changing. Technology is just crazy, and there's always someone coming to the plate to, you know, make what someone else invented better, or they better their own product. And so then the companies, you know, upgrade and update. I can't even tell you how many times my phone alone upgrades. I'm like, I'm tired of it. It's too much, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, we have to hire people to manage our technology.
Yeah, I believe that's the case. And it, so there should be jobs then, you know?
Well, right, there should be. And there are services that you can prescribe to that help you. I mean, look at Carbonite backing up your computers, you know?
Yeah.
There's so many widgets and gadgets and apps, they're called, that you can subscribe to manage your life. It's just, you're right. Well, who's driving whom? But Andrea Clinton, the creative process, it has to start somewhere. I mean, without a really good book, then what good is all the technology that can make it delivered?
That's true. That's very true. And it's, you know, a lot of people are writing books, and I've actually, I don't want to say any names, but I had a gentleman ask me to edit his book, and I told him it was too much, you know, too much on my plate, you know, right now. And what I wanted to do with him was not just edit his book, but also kind of teach him along the way. And then when I saw him like a year or two later, I said, so how'd everything turn out? And he said, well, you know, I just went ahead and wrote the book because I figured if I didn't, I never would write it. He said, but I made like a zillion mistakes. And I'm like, and these are the kind of things that are like happening. Some people, they just have a story and they want to tell it so bad, they just run and they go and do it. And they're, you know, I can understand, you know, where they're coming from, but it is a process and there is a learning to this. It's, you just don't, I have a story and jump up and, you know, go run and tell it. You know, you have to, everything from, you know, putting the dialogue in quotes, you know what I mean? It's just, it's a lot to learn. Theme, plot, you know, it's a lot involved. It's not I rolled out of bed one day and I had a story, so I ran and I wrote it and I published it next week. And I think Kindle and some of the other e-readers, I think they're going to offer that opportunity for people to just roll out of bed and just write a story and put it up there. Because it's very easy.
Yeah, I mean, look what happened with YouTube, another company that didn't exist a decade ago. Mm-hmm. You're right. You can make something at home out of your own creative genius, and it can become an instant multi-million worldwide success.
Yes.
Just like that.
Yeah, there was a woman who, she was doing some videos, and she wrote a company, I forgot what it's called. I know it's a shaper, and a lot of the overweight women wear them, even some men, and you kind of pull them up and put them on, and they're almost like sucking the life out of you. And this woman, she videotaped herself putting it on, and she, because I guess it's not as easy as just stepping in it. And so she discussed it and described it the whole way through, and she put the video up on YouTube. And I think now she's doing something with the company. And I couldn't believe it. There's been people to tell you how to tie a scarf, how to tie a tie on YouTube.
I know.
Can you imagine?
Exactly. I mean, and look what they get out of it—a lot.
Yeah.
They're getting a lot. They have sponsors, they have notoriety, success. I mean, you get invited on other programs. You know, it just, even their pets.
Yeah.
They'll show a cat or a dog that, you know, I mean, whatever. It's amazing what's happening with technology.
Yeah.
And of course, this is a literary show, everyone. It's authors first, you know, it's Tony Kay. But we're all influenced as you're driving down your car, listening to the broadcaster, or as you're sending it out and writing a tweet or in introducing people to this show. It's always out there in a way that is unique, in the sense that you're meeting Andrea Clinton, an author who's been recognized, reviewed. She is a phenomenal writer, and you wear a few other hats too. I believe you're dabbling in screenwriting.
Yes, actually, I have a couple of them I'm going to pitch. I'm just waiting. I don't know. Something is just telling me, be patient. But I have a couple of screenplays I wrote, one for Vivica Fox and one for Queen Latifah. And my family knows Queen Latifah's family, so I have the inside straight. But something's just telling me to just wait. So I'm just kind of listening to that and just kind of holding out. But, yeah, I have a few screenplays. I even know some actors and some producers and directors, and then I was just introduced to someone who I'm going to meet with soon, you know, and ask if he would be my manager. But I'm just, right now, I'm so into the whole publishing thing that I'm just trying to pace myself with that.
Tell our audience about Smashwords.com.
Okay. Well, yeah, I uploaded my book up on Smashwords. I was told, because, you know, the reason why a lot of people, I understand, put it up on Smashwords is because it opens up a much broader venue for you. You can have your books up on Sony Reader, iPad, putting it on PDF. People can see it on their laptop and on their computer. So it's pretty much just opening up doors for you to put your book in all of the platforms, but going through one vehicle. And they're actually not the only one that do it. There's even like a bookbaby.com or something like that. And there's like a couple I just saw the other day. But Smashwords is one of the ones that's up and coming. I actually have my book there, and I'm getting ready to put my other, but I do more Kindle sales. I don't do many Smashwords sales. I don't know what that's about.
You know, it's a matter of introduction. It has to get out there. You have to do something to drive it to the top of the list, right? Now, what I did when I Googled Andrea Clinton, author, it came right up there. And I clicked Smashwords.com to get your biography and so forth because it's all there. It's awesome.
Yeah. And I think also, too, Smashwords, a lot of people don't know it. Everyone knows Amazon. And everyone knows Barnes & Noble, but they don't too much know Smashwords. So I think it's one of those things, if they hang in there, people will, you know, begin to know them. But at least I know my audience. I'm getting the impression that they're not too familiar with it, not the readers. Like a lot of authors are and a lot of publishers, but I get the impression that a lot of readers aren't. Because I've literally, on my phone, I have probably about 300 people, and I've texted all of them the Smashwords website and said, please go buy a book. You can even load it on your Droid. And about 7 people did it. They were like, what is that? No, I'll get it from Amazon. I'll get it from Kindle, you know?
Well, that's what happens. You know, we get addicted to a particular, maneuvering a particular website and technology, I should say. And that familiarity brings us back to it all the time.
Yeah, and also I think, too, with your credit card over the internet, you would probably be a little bit more, you know, particular about who you know, giving your numbers to. And again, how many things have you bought from Amazon? Like, I just bought a box of dandelion tea from Amazon. So, you know, people are very familiar with Amazon. It's probably a household name right now at this point, almost like eBay.
Well, that's right. Well, audience, you're listening to Authors First, Tony Kaye in the studio, and we're just warming up and having a great time talking about authorship technology a little bit with Andrea Clinton, author of Life Knows No Bounds, found all over the World Wide Web. She has received high accolades and reviews. You can read them at your leisure or read them right now while listening to the broadcast, and be sure to send out to your friends on Twitter and social networks this very talented and ingenious author. It is that time of the year where we're looking for quality books. So, Andrea, give our audience an overview of Life Knows No Bounds. It's a series of books.
Yes, it is. Well, Life Knows No Bounds is a series, and the first book in the series came out in 2009, which was One Who Loves You More. And we discussed that book the last time on the show. That one is about a girl who's a gold digger. She's fresh out of high school. She doesn't know, you know, which way is up. But she wants to, you know, just do something with herself. And she's kind of bored and tired with school. And she sees all of her friends, you know, not going to school, but just using men for money. They're a little older than her, so they're like her mentors. And she's, you know, seeing them, you know, the glory of them with jewelry, credit cards, designer clothes and designer bags, and she wants that for herself. So she begins to follow in their footsteps. But with her parents coming down on her so hard, she, you know, her mother telling her, look, you're making me look bad because you have guys coming and going, you know, picking you up. And so she decides to just get her one man. And so she takes her great-grandmother's advice and decides to get one man who loves her more than she loves him. And she happens to get this guy, Omar, who lives in the community. But turns out Omar is a drug dealer, and he has his own battles. You know, he's trying to stop. His conscience is bothering him. He wants to go back to the religious life he knew before. And so now he's stuck. Like, do I keep doing the drug thing so that I can appease her and make her happy, or do I stop? So between him fighting good and evil and her, you know, pure wanting evil, you know, the whole gold digger thing, they clash. It's like Clash of the Titans, and it's like a lot of drama, a lot of, you know, just when you think, okay, things are going to work out and they're just going to be this cute couple, then more drama kicks off. Everything from street fights to shootouts to just everything, you name it. In the club, a lot of old songs, disco songs, you know, coming up. And, you know, it's written in realism, so I kept it, you know, really real. So that's the first book in the Life Knows No Bounds series. The second book is coming out next month, as a matter of fact. It'll be up on Smashwords and Kindle by the end of this month. Worst case scenario, it'll be the first week in December. That book is A Blessing and a Curse, and it's about a woman, she gets visions into the future, but she has a beautiful life. You know, she's adopted her brother-in-law because his mother was on drugs. She married a would-have-been star football player, but he's a assistant coach for a college team now. They're living in a nice house. They have twins. She's an artist. She works part-time in a gallery that she shares with two partners. So her life is just beautiful. You know, it's serene. But as Life Knows No Bounds states in the sort of mission statement in the beginning of the book, these characters will all be comfortable wherever they are, and life will snatch the rug from under them and leave them stunned, like, what's going on, you know, what to do. And they'll have these decisions that they have to make, whether it be to be good or to be evil or to do this or to do that. And so she has this decision that she has to make because in the very beginning, her husband tells her he's not happy with her. He wants to leave her, the kids, and the bills. And he doesn't really want to, but he feels like she's ignoring him. So she takes a trip to the islands, and she just learns some things she never knew about herself, about this vision, this foresight, you know, being able to see into the future. She just learns a whole lot, and as soon as she's coming back, she's like, okay, it's time to implement these things I've learned about myself. You know, she's going to accept what's going on and just try to rebuild her life. Where she thought the rug was snatched from under her, it had nothing on what happens to her when she comes home. And so just when you think that you knew what was going on, the rug is snatched from under her yet again. The first one was just a tiny little yank. The real snatching of the rug comes when she's on her way home. So it's a lot of twists and turns. It's almost like being at an amusement park, just when you think that you're going around the curve, it takes a dip down. So, and I purposely did it like that because I like books like that. I think they keep the audience intrigued. They keep them awake. And so, but I've got a lot of good feedback so far. And right now it's with the editor getting the final touches out before we put it up on Kindle and start to print.
Andrea, now, are these stories all self-contained, or will the audience recognize characters in subsequent volumes?
No, these stories are all different. It's almost like a Twilight Zone, and I don't know why that example is always first and foremost in my head, but it's like a bunch of different stories that, you know, every time a new book comes out, it's going to be another, you know, situation, another circumstance. The only thing that is consistent in each of the books, it's not even a person. It's not the protagonist or the antagonist. Well, it may be the antagonist because the antagonist is life. So every time, there's always going to be someone new. And the situation or the circumstances may be different, but the situation of life, you know, kind of snatching the rug from under them will be the same in every book. I even have part four where it's about an African girl. She grows up 900 A.D., and they're living in Africa along the River Nile. I didn't say exactly where because I just wanted people to kind of get an idea. But her father is in charge of the kingdom. He's the king, and, you know, they have a nice life going on. And the rug is snatched from under her because the guy she grew up thinking she was going to marry, she ends up falling in love with his enemy, and the enemy kidnaps her. So that book is called One Man is Smoke and the Other is Fire. So as you see, the thing they have in common is just when they thought, and we do that. Sometimes we get very comfortable in our position, only to turn around if something happens. It could be any kind of life event, a marriage. It could be a death. It could be someone in a bad car accident. Just crazy, you know, health issues, anything. Loss of a job, you know, the economy. And so we have to learn to rise to the occasion. And just when we do, and then we get comfortable and things go smooth for a while, for some of us, something else happens. For some of us, it's another thing happens right after, you know. But that's what I'm trying to convey in these, in this book, in this Twilight Zone type of life knows no bounds. You just constantly, these things, you know, that go wrong in life.
Yeah, I know. The pendulum can swing in extremes, both directions, and when they can collide, there goes your head, plop, it's on the ground.
Yeah.
You know, that's you're right. And I love the Twilight Zone. I'm the junkie. You know, all the black and whites, they do the series, they start, and then never get, and I'm there, man, right there, always. Put that on. I got it.
Oh, I love it.
I know. I'm horrible. I love it, too. But it was good writing. It was good writing.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
They didn't have a lot of technology. You really had to act.
No.
You really had to convince an audience to make them believe that this was happening.
Yeah, and that was seriously bringing your A-game, really.
It is. And the limits of technology, the camera, black and white, audio, I mean, everything. They had costume. I mean, what can you convey? What sense, if you have all this makeup on, if it's black and white, can't see it anyway. So they had lots of restraints, but the creative talent comes through. And that's what you can appreciate as a screenwriter, as a filmmaker yourself, as an author. That energy that goes into, I have to make these characters believable. I have to make this set work. The scene has to work.
Yeah, and the fact that I write in realism, it only makes it, you know, better or easier for me. Like, that is my genre. I love naturalism. I love realism because it's, you know, real-life events, you know, in fiction. But the reason why I love naturalism is because naturalism is like that extension of realism. It's not just real-life events and the things that happen to people and the choices they make, but it goes a little more into detail as far as why do they make those decisions. Darwin is the inspiration, and so they're stuck with these two drives. It's either self-preservation or species preservation. And self-preservation, you know, is self-explanatory, and species preservation is the argument of the man who wants the girl across the street because he's in love with her, or the man who's lusting for her, and he just thinks he's in love with her at first sight. And so these things all make up why the characters, you know, do what they do or have the decisions that they have to make. It's either self-preservation or it's either, you know, this drive, this sexual drive. And so I just love it. I love it because, to me, granted, I think there's more to why we make the decisions we make. I think it has a lot to do with inequalities, our parents and the way that they raised us, environment, you know, things that we're taught. I think all of those things come together. I don't think it's one, you know, or two drives that make a decision as to why we do what we do. But I like writing in them because they just kind of open up this big sphere for you to work in. And it actually works in it. Whether it's true and whether you want to add or take something away from it, it actually does work for good storytelling. And so I love writing in naturalism.
Why all men aren't dogs? Well, I thought they were, but the optimum word there is all. That's some realism. I like that. Hey, in your characters, who would we call out? Gwendolyn Carter. Who's she?
Well, Gwendolyn Carter is my mother / partner. She is the co publisher. And she acts heavily in the publicist and marketing area.
I know that. And now our audience does, too. But no, that wasn't my question.
Okay. I'm sorry. I thought you were going with character.
Yes,
from
your books. Who would she be? Does Gwen fit one?
If I had to say that she did, it would probably be in One Who Loves You More. She would probably be the mother of Elisa, because coming up, my mother was dead on my case. If I blinked wrong, she knew it. And sometimes people would say, well, Gwen, why are you so hard on her? Just, you know, give her room to... And my mother was looking at them like, are you crazy? And, like, pretty much I learned early that you couldn't be around her and think you were going to sneak and do something, because she just, the nose knows, you know? And that's why I feel I would definitely attach her to that character, like, 100%.
And you need people like that to believe in your project. It takes a lot of follow-up and energy. You know, that's that's a big job.
It is.
And it is. I think she's great. You're very fortunate.
Yeah, I'm blessed, and I'm very thankful. And I think about that a lot. And it's just, the funny thing is, like, the holidays come, and you wonder, you know, her birthday's coming. You're like, what do you do? But it's difficult because it just seems like there's nothing that you can buy her that would, you know, just even, you know, come close to saying thank you, you know, or to be worthy of, you know, what she does, you know, and not just for me, it's her daughter. Of course, me, it's her daughter, but, and my sister as well, but she's like that in the entire family. Like, she's the one to call when something happens.
Well, we have 50 authors scheduled for the next 5 weeks. With Christmas in there somewhere and Thanksgiving somehow. But we'll fit them all in, and I would love to have Gwendolyn Carter on that task.
Oh, that would be nice.
No, I'm not going to give...
She's working on a book, you know.
I'm not going to give her more work. Are you kidding me? But she'd be the one, though, to chase down these authors, that's for sure.
Yeah, and she's always communicating with them also.
I tell you, I have a tremendous respect for that position, and she does a great job for you, and it really it does take other people. It's just not possible to do everything on your own as an author and be very successful at it. You know, you try to do as much as you can, obviously, but there, you do reach points where you need other professional input and guidance and just plain energy. I mean, there's only so many hours in a day, right?
Really, and I have two interns, and I talked to another author. I thought she was going to say, well, you're abusing the privilege, and she said, well, you know, why don't you get some interns? And I said, I have some. She said, well, how many? I said, two, and I was a little reluctant to tell her, and she said, that's it? I said, oh, my God, how many do you have? She said she has, like, six. She has two working in marketing and publicity, one for graphics design, a backup. She has two that help her with the regular day-to-day, and by her having so many of them, and she does give them like a bonus every now and again, she said it saves her money, the job gets done, and she's able to spend more time writing. So I said, I'm going to be like her when I grow up. I'm like, you know, looking to, you know, start doing that. But I have two right now, and probably will go up to the college and try to get a couple more. I mean, it is a tremendous job. And my hat off to all the publishers, big, small, medium. But, you know, those who do the job and they aim to do the job right, I have a whole new respect. I couldn't understand for the life of me. I studied the publishing industry for about 10 to 12 years, not to be a publisher. This was something that someone had told me, my last publicist told me, that I should do because I had lupus and we didn't know if I was going to live. And she said, you know, you shouldn't wait. You could take a long time, you know, submitting queries and all of that. She said, go ahead and just do it. If you live, you can always submit them later. But right now, she said, just go ahead and get your books published. And so that's why I did it. But I never wanted to be a publisher. It was the last thing on my mind. When I studied it, I only studied it because I wanted to know why the publisher got 75%. I couldn't fathom it. You know, but after even reading it, I said, okay, I kind of sort of understand, but I felt like anybody can write anything, you know, and say anything on paper. But now that I'm actually doing it, my hat is off, and if someone made me a good offer, I would take it because it is a lot involved, especially, look, it's a lot involved, and I just got my books over in Europe, in Germany, France, England, and recently Australia. I just got them over there, and I haven't even began to start promoting them as yet. And so it's a big job just having been here in the U.S., and I'm not even all across the country. You see, so I can only imagine, even though they have pull, they have the money and the means, and they've been doing it so long, they pretty much have the whole situation sewed up, my hat is still off to them because I've grown a whole new respect for the publishing industry. And you won't get a lot of authors who will say that, because some of them, aside from having the creative control, some of them still want to get that 75%. Don't get me wrong, I wouldn't mind it, but it's a lot of work. And I think I can make even more work, you know, even more money just pushing out the books.
Andrea Clinton, our guest on Authors First with Tony Kaye, thank you so much for supporting the arts on Artists First Radio and being our guest. I'd like to welcome our listeners from Afghanistan, Istanbul, Turkey, all over Russia, England, Europe, oh my, France, hello, Pere. Nice to hear from you too. Obviously, everyone speaking English, U.S. government, 70 other nations. Hello in China. I'm not sure what time it is there, but welcome aboard. Let's see. B. King, I think, is that clock correct? No, it's not. At any rate, welcome everyone worldwide to the Artists First Radio Network. Thousands of hours available free on demand from the website. You're listening live to an interview with Andrea Clinton. She also joined Artists First Radio February 1st of 2011, and you will find under Authors First, alphabetically, her name and another interview. So be sure to download that show and share it with everyone you know. Questions, comments, you can send them to dj@artistfirst.com. And I should see if we have emails, since I never do. I don't see one yet, but that's okay. You're welcome to send them. And if they're nice, I'll read them. And if they're not, I won't. Okay. And now, Andrea Carter, where can our audience reach you? Do you have an email or Facebook or some other location they should be aware of?
Yes. I'm at Around the Way Pub, P-U-B, at AOL.com. That's, of course, the email. And I'm on
your
Twitter.
Name's Clinton anyway. Clinton.
Yes.
Like the
yes.
president. Like the famous artist. Is that country artist?
No, that's funk.
Oh,
that's
funk.
My uncle. Yeah, that's my uncle George.
Oh, yeah, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Yeah, we've been up there, Scott and I and my partners at Artists First Radio. We're not that far away from the Rock Hall and Cleveland, Ohio.
Okay. Well, you know what? I went to a show that they did for him. It was an appreciation show. They gave him an award, and all the hospitals in New York came together, and they did it at the Apollo. And it was, oh, my God, I enjoyed myself. I have not, the first show, I thought I enjoyed myself a lot until I went to this show. Nona Hendrix was there. Boosie Collins was there. Full Force was there. Like, all these singing groups, you just name it. It was a lot of love and support that was there for him, so... he just turned 70 not long ago, so this was, like, all really good. Matter of fact, they showed a short clip, a lot of celebrities, you know, giving him, you know, paying homage to him and, you know, kind of saluting him. Chris Rock has some really crazy jokes to say about him. He thought he was going to hug him tight when he sees him because he knows he's going to die soon. It was crazy. I mean, we all cracked up laughing and, you know, ate, talked, laughed, and just had a lot of fun. It was really nice.
Congratulations. So what a fabulous memory that you'll have and you'll share with your family for generations to come. The creative arts, something you've grown up with and been exposed to all your life. And did you have others in your family with literary interests?
Not literary. As far as I see, I look like I'm the only one. But on the Clinton side, singers, actors, actresses, and that seems to be the bulk of it, really. Like, they're really into entertainment. And my grandfather, George's father, he's George Clinton Sr., and he was a singer for many years. And then he, you know, eventually, you know, stopped and just worked and took care of his family. But it seems like every offspring, everyone that is the fruit of his loin is just totally into the arts in some form or fashion. And I knew they were singers. I just didn't know they were into, like theater and, you know, acting and so on and so forth. Like, I had a cousin who just moved out to California to pursue her career. So it's a lot of arts going on the Clinton side.
And professionals. I mean, you have to be skilled, disciplined, apply your talent, be trainable, have others.
Yes.
You're learning new things all the time in the way of choreography and material and perfecting your own artistic ability. It's a big job. It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
It really is.
Anytime you're performing in some form of fashion, like even with, actually, I don't know if I should say this, but cross on my fingers, I just put in my paperwork to go for my master's. A couple of professors have kind of been on me. One professor in particular I'm very close with, she's been really on me to go and to get my master's because I want to do theater. And my first book, One Who Loves You More, was just picked up by a producer. And so I just decided, okay, well, if I'm going to start doing some plays, you know, I want to get my degree. I was going to do film, but it's just way too expensive, like $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a semester. That's just crazy. So I said, I'm going to just, you know, I'll do it in theater. That was my second plan. So I'll just get my degree and, you know, my master's in theater. And so I'm actually getting ready to go. So I'm just really looking forward to that.
Now, Andrea, will you couple that with the degree in education? In other words, will you be teaching at some level?
Well, you know, that's so funny you said that. Oh, my God. I was just offered a job as a professor at a community college in Essex County. And I'm actually going to meet with the chair, I think, probably either the end of this month or next month. So we'll see what happens. There's a lot of things coming in my direction, but they're floating kind of fast. That's why I said I better hurry up and get some more interns. But it's a lot of good opportunities, and I don't want to miss it.
Yeah, I mean, and you can, of course, teach while you're continuing your master's degree.
Yeah,
you know, some actually, things you can do concurrently. I don't know how much creative writing you'll get done.
But actually, you know, I have four more books that are done. And so really, I think the real issue is probably hiring two people, if I do take the job at the college, hiring two people to actually do the work that I'm doing now, because this job is like constant. It's like a kid pulling on your coattail all day, every day. I had to like literally train myself to just try to do something in the day and then relax, because you get agita and, you know, everything, like everything is due yesterday or right now, you know. So that's the big thing. I know I can do the college and I can, you know, teach, and I probably would only do a couple of classes anyway, you know, during the week. But the big thing is going to be the publishing. That's the baby that cries the loudest.
November 2011, Life Knows No Bounds presents Where Do We Go From Here?
Exactly.
And Where Do We Go From Here? And how do you come up with these one-liners that you end up building a fabulous story around?
You mean like the subtitles for each chapter?
Yes.
Wow. Some of them, they just fit. Like when I had to, you know, just think of the chapter and what was going on to come up with a title, some things would just kind of pop into my head based on old sayings or things like that, or just, like, I'm also a poet. I write a lot of poetry, so sometimes I could get a little something, you know, put together or whatever. But some of them, I don't think any chapter I wrote based on the title. It just kind of worked out pretty good. Now I'm on a second book. That's my big thing. I have about 12 chapters that don't have titles yet. And I'm like, what am I going to do? So I told the editor, I was like, you know, kind of point me in a direction based on the chapter or whatever. Because I didn't focus too much on it this time. I was even thinking about just doing chapter numbers. But then I have a very close friend of mine who is a book reviewer. And she said to me, don't you dare. She said, that's your signature, to do the chapters by those little taglines or those little, you know, words of wisdom or sarcastic or sarcasms or whatever. So I said, okay, so I'm back to the drawing board now.
Yeah, well, that's all right, though. You're right. You do develop a signature when you write a lot of material, and you have a particular frame of reference that guides you through each book. As you stated earlier in the broadcast, the show, that each book is independent. It's not required. You can jump in anywhere. You don't need to have previous books to understand later books, correct?
Yeah, they all stand alone. However, I have been getting such feedback from One Who Loves You More, the first book, and everyone, they are on my back so much that my mother/publicist manager is on my neck. She's like, you have to do a part two. You have to. It, to the point, over the summer, I had to begin laying a blueprint out for part two, and I had no intention of doing part two. And I spoke to, I was on a couple of panels with a few other authors, and we get together and talk after. And when I told them that, they said, you had better do it. They said, you can lose an audience by not supplying their demand. And they, and so I'm like, wow. So I went to the table, and I just started thinking about the characters and their personality and what they really want. They've heard the gold digger. They've heard her point of view. Now they want to know the guy's point of view, the guy who was the drug dealer and, you know, who was trying to, you know, get back on the right path, but then he has to deal with her wanting money and jewelry and all of that. So I just began laying it out, and it actually was not as bad as I thought because, you know, his personality has already been formed and shaped, and his family and his friends and everybody. So it's actually coming really well. It's coming together really well. And it even inspired me. One of the other characters that I would have thought people wanted to hear more about, Tracy, she's actually the one who the girl looks up to. But she's like a she's something else. She's something off of a Beretta movie. You ever see those prostitutes on Beretta, and they're just kind of crazy, and you're just like, oh my goodness, is she really out there like that? That's how this. She has that kind of cutthroat personality, like a Pam Grier in some of Pam Grier's movies.
This is, yeah, this only is, on TV though. I've not been there.
Well, yeah, yeah. Well, this is her. This is Tracy. Tracy has that kind of cutthroat personality. She's had some things happen to her as a kid, and so she's, because of it, she's kind of a renegade, and she's really pissed off, and it's coming out in her demeanor. She don't tell her about a psychiatrist. She doesn't want to hear about sitting and talking to, you know, Big Mama or Grandma. She just leave her alone. This happened to me. I'm a bitter bastard, and, you know, men are going to pay. And so she's just out there using men for money, and whenever someone does something to her, she's just kind of off the chain. Because, and the reason why I did it was because, like I said, when people read the first book, they said, why is Tracy the way she was? Because it was like I gave them a taste of her, and they felt she was probably more interesting than the main character, because they wanted to beat the main character up. But Tracy, the one she was following, they were like, you know, what makes her tick? So that book, I began to write that as well, and I think that's going to be a hit. I really think that's going to be, I can't even explain it.
Wow, it must be exciting to know that you've connected with the audience. They're, you know, engaged. They want to know what's going on, and they're into the storyline.
I love when they demand, because, you know, I literally, they probably thought I was crazy because I met with a book club one day, and they were telling me, like, you know, and I want to talk about Tracy. I want to, you know, I went there prepared to talk about Elisa, the main character, but they wanted to know more about Tracy. And so I'm sitting there, and it touched me so much because I had started writing about Tracy. And so I'm smiling, and then I began to shed tears. So they probably said, what is wrong with her? But I was just so happy that, you know, we were like eye to eye with this, you know, thing with Tracy, you know. But again, that book, believe me, that book, the part two of the first book, as well as another book I wrote, Notes and Messages, if any book would put me on the map, I believe those would be the books. Because those are the, out of all the ones that are coming out in the next 2 years, aside from, you know, I'm writing a book about my Uncle George Clinton and the family, his family, you know, coming up and growing up in North New Jersey and so on. Aside from that, I believe that those are the three books that, if any books, would, you know, get me a huge audience. Because they're so real, some people probably would have to put them down. Like, the in-depthness that I go into about the drugs or the drug addicts and the kids growing up in the household with the drugs, you know, those kind of things. I'm not cutting any shorts. I'm not watering anything down. I'm giving it to them exactly how it happened, with real dialogue, real situations. I'm describing the setting in the room exactly the way you would see it in the community. So I think those will be the ones.
Tony Kay was not there. Okay, audience, just relax. I wasn't there. I'm not involved, okay? It goes back to realism. You feed on that. You like the connectedness of reality and how it can play out in these make-believe parts. But in this case, you're talking about some real-life issues, a biography, pulling no punches. Now, that doesn't that open, are you open yourself up to a little bit of family alienation?
No, I don't think so. My family, they pretty much know how I am. They know if I know it or if I saw it or if I heard of it or if I whatever, I'm going to put it out there. And they know that because I'm also the editor-in-chief of Amistad newspaper. And so, you know, we had our arts and entertainment section. We had our news, our commentary. And so when you see my additions to it, they just knew if something struck me or if it hit me, I was going to tell it. It was going in there. So I don't think that, you know, I don't think it'll do anything aside from just they'll just say, oh, yeah, she wrote that, you know. And with my uncle, George, when we sat and watched Unsung at his granddaughter's house the night that, you know, it premiered, and he told me he was proud, and I shed tears. I really did. He doesn't get too emotional, so I didn't want to, you know, really cry, but I shed tears because, you know, I didn't expect that. It was his night. You know, we were sitting together to watch Unsung and, you know, to talk about it and everything and, you know, listen to some of what he had to say about it. And, you know, all of a sudden it turned, it was on, well, actually this was before we watched it. We were there talking for about an hour or two and it just turned on me. You know, he asked me about the book and what am I doing. And he asked me why was everybody calling me Andrea. He didn't know that wasn't my first name because my family knows me as Renee. So he was like, why the hell are they calling you Andrea? Who is that? And I said, that's my first name. And he was like, oh. So we had a lot of fun. And it was, you know, it was real exciting. And it was very touching because he asked a lot of questions about the book and what I was up to. And so, you know, I think he'll be proud as well.
Well, absolutely. There's no question. If we survive a decade or two of an era where things were, you know, a little different, okay?
Yeah.
I have a little trouble with people who judge the past too harshly.
Yeah.
So, you know, if we are fortunate to survive the past and move on to the future, we could achieve great things.
Yeah. Honestly, because some of my first book was put in urban. I don't mind, whatever, because they'll see. Some books they just won't be able to squeeze in urban. They may say African-American, but they won't be able to squeeze because it just won't fit. And the second book actually is one. It just doesn't fit. But I don't mind what anybody thinks because I didn't grow up in the pits or in Well, maybe I shouldn't say that because that'd be untrue. I did grow up in the inner community, the hood, the ghetto, or whatever. But on my mother's side, my grandmother and grandfather helped raise me, and they were a Baptist minister and so on. And so I lived in a pretty middle-class family there. And then my mother, she was a single mom, and she helped to raise me. So I did live, you know, in the area she could afford, which was not far from the hood or the ghetto or whatever. And we all went to school together. They didn't separate. They didn't say, okay, you know, the hood people go to that school and, you know, the middle class and so on go. No, we all went to the same school. And so growing up, although I can't say that I lived in some of the roughest and most wretched, you know, neighborhoods, I did live among them and around them, and I did see a lot of things. So, you know, it's a kind of, you know, it's a weird situation. And I always felt awkward going to college because I would talk to my professors and, you know, they would have one, you know, way of seeing me. And then, you know, they would tell me to write, okay, it's time for us to do our next story. What are you going to do it on? And then when I would write it, then they would, how do you know this? Like, and they would look at me weird. They just couldn't figure me out and they couldn't get me. And the only answer I could give is I wish I didn't get me either. Like, you know, some of the things that I saw and know, you know, no kid or no person should have to see or whatever. But I don't want to make it seem like a lot of people who write urban fiction or who write about those things, they have lived the life. They've, you know, tested the waters. I cannot say that I've tested the waters. I'm too scary. I don't know what the inside of a jail looks like except for when I went to visit. You know, I've never been arrested in the back of a cop car. So I can't say that. And I try my best not to make it seem that way. But I know it probably kind of comes off that way in the writing because it's so detailed with some of the gory facts that happened in, you know, that life.
you're very passionate about giving back, reaching out to people. You've developed a tremendous literary style. You love English literature. You're well-read. You're applying that gift in many fields. But at the same time, you're finding time to give back. You also are the CEO of a nonprofit organization called Yes. People Helping People, Inc. Mm-hmm. Tell our audience about that venture and how they could get involved.
Well, I started People Helping People to try to help people to become independent and self-sufficient. I believe when I started that, Clinton was in office. So it wasn't hard. It wasn't difficult to help. There was a lot of money out there, a lot of grants and so on and so forth. And although I didn't get any grants, it was still a lot of opportunity. Those other nonprofits who did get grants would welcome, you know, our organization in and would allow us to, you know, do a lot with the funds that they had. You know, bring your people in or here, you know, these are some referrals for your people and so on. And so we were able to help a lot of people, and that's what we're still trying to do today. The only difference is that there are no funds. And so, you know, with the economy the way that it is, with the cutbacks that the government is having and has, you know, had, they're just no fun. So right now everything we're doing is really referrals, sending them to, you know, different agencies, be it welfare, unemployment, to homeless prevention, other agencies that help with their bills and so on, NAAA. You know, basically that's what we're doing, and we do offer counseling. So that's pretty much what we've been reduced to because of the financial situation and the economy. You know, it's just kind of helping people the best way we can with what little that we have.
And you're correct. All not-for-profits are struggling with the same issues. We are here at Artists First Radio. Expenses continue to climb. Contributions continue to go down. So, you know.
Yeah. Yeah,
and those of us who love the arts support it, and we give benevolently financially and also of our time to keep the radio station running. And at some point, we hope that all that will turn around with some appropriate advertising revenue that would defer our operating costs at Artists First Radio. But thank you, Andrea Clinton, for being our guest and for sharing your family, your passion. And the information is all available on the World Wide Web audience. You won't be disappointed. We invite you to buy the books. They're very affordable. I think the paperbacks are what, like $8.99 or something?
On the website, I think I've reduced it to $8.99. However, if you go to www.amazon.com/shops/cupcakestatus, my daughter is selling them, I believe, for like $6.99. So she's got them like even cheaper.
Thank you for being our guest supporting the arts on Artists First Radio. Tony Kaye in the studio. Before I let you go, anyone out there on planet Earth you'd like to say hello to?
I guess my family, friends, all the professors, and just people who supported me and encouraged me, to you. Every time I talk to you, you just give such kind words of encouragement, you know, and we need supporters like that because it's rough. If you think it's rough for the guy who works in the diner, it's really rough for authors right now because, again, with the economy the way it is, books are really the last thing on people's mind unless they're, like, really avid readers. And even with that, like, for them, it's worth to invest in a Kindle, you know, and get a book for 99 cents. So I just want to say, you know, shout out to everybody and say thank you to everybody who supports authors and what we're, you know, trying to do to, you know, bring our form of entertainment. I want to thank one of my greatest inspirations, who was my Uncle George Clinton, again, the funk group Parliament Funkadelic, my grandmother, who, you know, started me out writing, my mother, who was one of my greatest supporters, and just, again, all the friends and everybody else, my sister, Karen, who, you know, also supports, and my kids.